It's definitely hard to share something that might not make sense for others, but I love hearing that you've had other people share those moments of their own. And I think that ultimately, hopefully, that it invites other people to look for their own special moment like that in their own way. I think that's the beauty of humanity, is that we all have our own story and our own unique connection with spirituality, with nature. And the more we dive into that, the more these types of moments can be revealed. So hopefully it encourages others to get out there and experience.
Welcome to Care More, Be Better, a podcast for people like you who care about the social impact of conscious companies and everyday heroes. Hear inspiring stories from those who put people and planet before profit and personal gain. You'll learn how you can make a difference, vote with your dollars, and get involved today. Here's your host, Karina Bellizzi.
Hello, fellow do-gooders and friends. I'm your host, Karina Bellizzi. Today, I invite you to dive back into the Blue Mind way of thinking that we learned when we connected with Wallace J. Nichols about his work. You know, he's that marine biologist, a New York Times bestseller, really behind Get Us Thinking about what it takes to connect and commune with nature and how important water is in our world and how we connect with one another, how being on, in, under, or near water can change our perspectives. As I introduce you to one more incredible person who has lived this ideal for so many years. Captain Liz Clark is a sailor, a surfer, and an activist for our blue ocean planet. Over the course of more than 10 years and having traveled over 20,000 nautical miles, Liz has lived a dream that she cultivated from the age of 9. After returning from a year sailing, she knew two things. She wanted to be the captain of her own sailboat, and she wanted to protect the natural world from the perils of human destruction. In her memoir, which I have right here with me, Swell, A Sailing Surfer's Voyage of Awakening, which was published by Patagonia Press, and which will be available in paperback May 14th, 2024, Liz invites us on both her inner and outer journeys of discovery. Through this book, we get a glimpse behind the curtain through pictures from her travels sailing south from Southern California through Central America and the Pacific Islands. She provides a willing and vulnerable view of what it's like to be a young woman sailing around the world, often alone in a 40-foot sailboat. She transparently shares the challenges that she faced, from the mechanical woes of a captain to her internal and emotional struggles and transformation. This is an intimate journey as she learns to follow her intuition and build an inner, confident strength. Captain Liz Clark, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Karina. I'm honored to be here.
Well, I truly enjoyed your book, and I know that we're bound to share a few spoilers today for those that might read it, but they really should pick this up and hear it in your words or in your voice, even the way I also listened to it on Audible. But I wanted to kick off this journey today with your why. Why did you decide to undertake this incredible and difficult journey?
Well, I think it was a mix of a few things. I studied environmental studies at University of California, Santa Barbara. At that time, I felt like we were off course in a lot of ways as a society. And I was looking for a way to live a life that aligned with my values and my concern for environmental protection and wanting to live closer to nature. And after I graduated, I also had the travel bug and I really wanted to see the world, and seeing it by boat, having done that as a child with my family, I saw what an amazing experience it was to be able to bring your home with you and travel by sailboat to various places around the world.
And pick up and drop anchor somewhere else, right?
Yeah. Bring your home with you. It's a pretty neat way to go. And I had become really involved in surfing and competitive surfing throughout my years at university. And I was really wanting to discover remote waves. And this also seemed like a really cool way to have all of those passions and desires collide into this big adventure. And at a time in my life in your 20s where self-exploration and exploration of the world can kind of go hand in hand and forge you as a person.
Yeah, I have to say too, when you are listening to that inner voice and that desire and taking the big risks, sometimes it seems like the world kind of aligns around you and pushes you in this direction. In fact, you're developing friendship with Dr. Barry Skyler, who operated as your mentor, is just one such example. I had this question as I was reading the book and listening to the audiobook too, kind of interchangeably going back and forth, wondering whether you might have followed this dream and this path if it had not been for him and how your life might have been different. I imagine that's something you've reflected on over the years. So I was hoping you could share your thoughts.
Yeah, absolutely. It's always something that comes back and comes up because he had such a huge impact and still has such a huge impact on my life. And it was kind of like catching a falling star, meeting him and having his support. I think one way or another, I wanted to do this trip, but doing it with him and having, in terms of my safety, in terms of the knowledge that I acquired through him before leaving, and then just having him kind of as my rudder in terms of the bigger causes that I was out there to represent, he was really absolutely essential to making all that possible for me. Yeah, I probably would have tried to do it on a boat that was much less safe and prepared and probably wouldn't have gotten as far, or it would have happened way later in my life after having to save up money. So yeah, undoubtedly, Barry had a huge, huge impact on the way this trip happened and on how my life has unfolded and continues to be an inspiration to me as I, you know, recommit to my environmental activism in a different way now. So yeah, he continues to be with me.
It had me thinking about the few people in my life as I was getting going that really showed me that they believed in me. Because I think that when you're tackling something really hard, just the idea of sailing across the Pacific Ocean as a female captain on your own, encountering potential dangers, but maybe you just don't have some of the skills that a guy growing up being taught by their man to turn a wrench, like, I mean, their man, their dad or something like that in their culture of their home, you might just not have that inborn existing kind of background knowledge that comes with it, even if you did grow up as a tomboy, because maybe your dad didn't spend the time saying, oh, here's how you work on the rudder, or this is the clutch assembly for the car, whatever that is, where you learn these skills along the way. And so, I mean, I just found in reading the book and all the prep work, everything that goes into getting ready to go on a voyage like this, like there were so many moments where you could have just said, I'm pulling the plug. I can't do this. Either something's not coming together with the boat and it's hard, or the person that was supposed to be with me for part of this journey isn't going to be there anymore. And now I'm discouraged.
My father was the other person who's absolutely responsible for giving me the confidence and supporting my wild ideas and always telling me you can do it. Without having been the culture of my youth, the feeling that I was always given by him, I don't think that I would have already had guts to tell myself that I wanted to do this. And then meeting Barry, who just added to my practical knowledge and having his financial support, having his emotional support. Between the two of them, they convinced me that I was capable, and I so badly wanted it that it was really helpful to have that support. And over and over and over again, there was a million things I didn't know how to do, and I ran into a wall. And having that voice behind me saying, you can learn, you can figure it out, you're capable, always helped me get over that initial, another thing that I have to figure out, another thing that's blocking me from getting to where I want to go, or however it played out at the time. Absolutely, had I not had that deep support from the two of them, I don't think I would have even tried.
Well, I can empathize. I've actually captained a sailboat a couple of times with a crew, and as like team building events and things like that, right? And So as I read the book, I'm thinking here, okay, so she did part of this journey by herself, and it's a 40-foot boat. Like, there is so much that goes into making sure, like, even just changing tack, that you're remaining on course, that you're okay, if your instruments, if something's failing, if your autopilot isn't working great. Like, there's just so many things that have to be managed. It's really ideal to have two or three people on a boat that size to be able to manage it. So I just was in awe of the endeavor itself and everything that it took to get together. So I just want to say I'm proud of you as one woman to another for thinking I can do this and then for making it happen. All the support aside, it's an incredible feat for anybody to accomplish this. And I was right with you throughout the story. That's how it felt. Now, while you had people join you for segments of your travels, the only real constant, of course, was you. And so much of what you did was on your own. What stands out for you specifically from the time that you spent by yourself on the ocean?
What stands out the most during that time was my internal growth and my development as a young woman, just finding her way, learning myself and learning to love myself. That time alone was so, so essential to me. Just having the space and the context to just slow down and learn who I am, learn what I loved, and decide who I wanted to be. I think I'm a born nurturer, and when I'm around other people, which is how I grew up and how I kind of always was in my teen years, I was always looking around at everyone else to make sure everyone else was happy. And I think when I finally got time alone, I was able to listen within and really ask myself those questions. What makes me feel good? What do I want? And concentrate on some of the blocks that I had in myself to being the person who I wanted to be. Being alone on a sailboat, you have all this time and you're just like a little bit separate from society, which just for me allowed me that peace and serenity in terms of my surroundings to have the capacity to hear myself and start to develop that real sense of who I am.
One of the things that really struck me in your work is this reflection on being a young woman and what it takes to even feel like you can be feminine and be uniquely yourself. The expectations you might have coming out of somewhere like an environment in Southern California where the beauty standards might be a little skewed and sometimes somewhat extreme, right? You know, you have to have a certain type body, your boobs have to be a certain way, you got to have these curves, but too slimmer here, and you're supposed to dress this way, act this way, have this manicure. It can get a little bit restrictive, let's just say. So stepping into yourself and your own beauty, you often seem to be asking the sky questions, the clouds, nature around you. And you describe this moment in the book where you're in a moment of self-doubt almost, and the clouds seem to answer you. You want to talk about that for a moment?
That particular moment was very special, very extraordinary, and I can't explain it to this day. But yeah, I was sailing across the Pacific with my mom at the time. I think we were about a week and a half out from the Galapagos heading towards the Marquesas Islands. And I had met a guy before I left, and we were going to stay in contact during the passage. He was a really good sailor, and we'd had a really special time together. And I really was thinking about him so much, and I hadn't heard from him for several days. And I started to have all this self-doubt and wonder if it was because of how I looked or if I wasn't good enough in this way or that. And it was a full moon that night. I was up on deck, and it was just one of the most spectacular nights at sea I can remember. There were these tall cumulus clouds that just looked like sculptures, and the moonlight bouncing off them in the sea, black and sparkly with the moonlight. And I looked up, and in the form of the cloud was a woman lying on her back with her arms behind her head, kind of looking up at the universe. And I mean, she was just so perfect. I couldn't understand what I was seeing. It wasn't like the normal cloud shape that you see when you look up and you think, oh, that kind of looks like a rabbit or whatever. She was absolutely perfect. And I just got this overwhelming sense that everything was going to be okay and that I was perfect too, no matter my faults. And I just felt this sense of peace that she was trying to convey to me, or that was trying to be conveyed to me. I can't explain exactly what was happening. But yeah, I never really told anyone about that moment until the book I wrote about it. And it was a defining moment for me in terms of just accepting myself as I am and appreciating myself and concentrating my love back on myself versus worrying about whether someone else liked me because of this or that. So yeah, it was a very beautiful moment with nature, kind of feeling recognized and beautiful for who I am.
It struck me in so many ways and also reminded me of a few moments in my own life where you suddenly just had this kind of clarity, this kind of knowledge, and where you really do feel like you know yourself or the universe a little bit better. And there are a couple of podcasts I can actually point back to, a couple of episodes where I've had people in similar moments, like Alexander Inchbold. He mentions being in this really difficult situation where he's trying to paint in the outdoors. And there was a virtual whiteout happening, but he's trying to capture the way nature is and in this moment, in this space, as part of his work. And he said he heard as if from outside, but inside, paint the wind. And then like this knowledge that the wind was communicating with him and saying something along the lines of, I mean, I'm paraphrasing here, but everybody fears me, but I'm ever present and powerful. And this is part of you as much as me and something to that effect, right? And as he's leaning into this moment and painting what he sees as the wind, suddenly the whiteout stops and the clouds lift and he has this perfect, beautiful view of this mountain range and this majestic space. And he's like, I can't explain the moment and the words I give don't do it justice, but it's just this knowledge that I feel like I was gifted. And I feel like it's very similar to what you experienced. And Therese Jannari, she's the climate optimist and she likes to try and invite people to be optimistic even in the face of all the challenges that we face, right? She talks about receiving downloads from nature. And when she gets to her quiet space, and it's always outside, it's always under the great expanse, having these just moments of clarity materialize as if she's always known it. But you also even hear these amazing individuals like Sadhguru himself. He'll tell you, like, I don't have to read the religious works. I'm listening to the voice in here, right? We're dulled. We all get dulled to that because we're given this barrage of constant information. And I think that's something that you talk about in your work, like getting that time to spend time alone and really be in self-reflection can, I think, move you into a different space and give you a new kind of knowledge and where you feel more connected to yourself, but also to the greater world, so that we don't feel so alone and lonely, which I just think it's such a gift. And I mean, to be a fly on the wall, but that experience is yours and yours alone. And I think it's amazing that you could share it. And the way you did describe it in the book was exceptional. And even for our audience here now, really, I commend you for being so transparent in it, because it's hard to be that vulnerable.
It's definitely hard to share something that might not make sense for others. But I love hearing that you've had other people share those moments of their own. And I think that ultimately, hopefully, that it invites other people to look for their own special moment like that in their own way. I think that's the beauty of humanity, is that we all have our own story and our own unique connection with spirituality, with nature. And the more we dive into that, the more these types of moments can be revealed. So hopefully it encourages others to get out there and experience
Well, I think too, it's the moments alone that allow you to get into quite enough space to be able to commune with that. I personally traveled alone in my 20s backpacking through Europe, and people thought I was perhaps a little crazy for doing that at 22, but I stayed in hostels. I sometimes arrived at weird times and had to walk a number of miles to get to the hostel that was now closed, and it's middle of the night type thing. You know, you just travel. It happens. But in these moments, I also found that I'd go inside and get like some new faith in myself. And in the moments where I felt weakest, because there were moments where I felt weak and like I just couldn't keep going, maybe I should just go home, like change my airfare and just go back to normal life, so to speak. Then suddenly, as I was listening to something inside, I'd get exactly what I needed in the moment. And in one of those cases, I was in this random town in northern France, right? Random town. It was just like a pit stop before I was going somewhere else. And I ended up at this hostel in this time when the whole town had shut down. Everybody was on vacation and like there was almost no travelers in the space. Like everyone was somewhere else. And I happened to arrive at the same time that another woman did. And she had exactly the same itinerary of things that she wanted to do. And so we became travel partners when each of us were feeling at our most lonely. And I feel like these things, like you could call them coincidences, but in a way, I feel like they're just gifts from the universe when you are in that moment, when you listen to your intuition, when you put the power of intention out there, that the world can align behind you and you can essentially be introduced to a Dr. Barry helping you get the boat that you'll need to go on this journey of self-discovery. Perhaps we can partly live vicariously through you, but also probably because he's working to pay it forward to someone that can embrace life with love and embrace the things he loved as much as he did. As he was in his 80s, right? So unable to go on the journey with you.
Yeah, absolutely. It is that space of vulnerability and deciding like, yes, I really want this at all costs, whether it's to go backpacking through Europe or take a big sailboat journey. Or I think it's that decision to put yourself in that vulnerable space that does seem to open you up more quickly to the kinds of serendipities and things that start to convince you that, yes, it's hard, but you're on the right path and it's going to be okay. And it's worth everything that it took to get there and keep going, you know?
Now, in your journeys, because you are so connected with this ocean world, you made this comment early on in the book about having been on these travels to Mexico and seeing people, trash, litter, stuff like this, just living in conditions where you aren't necessarily respecting the natural world as much as you might expect people to in that situation. But I just am very curious about how you encountered things like pollution and the environmental degradation that you saw personally, and whether or not you've seen any improvements at all since that time, and so far as how perhaps local spaces are managing plastic pollution. So what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I have been in a lot of places since I was young that plastic pollution was an issue. And at the moment, I would say that I haven't been traveling outside of where I live now in French Polynesia enough to really say whether things have improved or not. But I know here locally, there's definitely been an awareness that's grown and that there's less and less plastic pollution seen here locally, the trash that comes from here itself. We do get the trade winds that bring trash from other places that accumulates on the windward sides of the islands often. But I would say that the general consciousness about plastic and plastic pollution has definitely become more mainstream, and that is having a positive impact. I know that it's a big uphill battle, though, and even in the projections of plastic production are just getting bigger and bigger, and there's a lot of work to do. But you see so many inspiring movements, from the efforts to pull plastic from the Great Garbage Patch to giant cleanup efforts that are creating microeconomies around harvesting plastic off of beaches and places like that. So many new and innovative ways to affront the plastic pollution crisis. I would like to think that we're on our way to things getting better.
I'd like to think it too. I haven't been to Tahiti myself, but I do go to Hawaii with relative frequency, and I'm a scuba diver. And so I like to get in the water and see how things are just globally. And I found that being here in California along the coast of Monterey, things are pretty preserved because it's, you know, an ocean sanctuary, essentially. And there's a pretty sizable chunk that is set aside to essentially rest and protect the animals that are there, right? But you travel some other spaces, and especially where there are coral reefs, you're seeing a lot of die-off. And I know that's one part pollution, it's one part the chemicals in the oceans, it's one part ocean warming. Like, there's no one thing that is causing it. It's a lot of culmination of several different things. And that you were also, I believe, sponsored by a cleaner sunscreen. So how do you prevent, let's say, sunscreens in your own mindful way in Tahiti and beyond? And what practices might you suggest that we all consider when it comes to getting into the water?
Yeah, sure. So as someone who needs sunscreen and wears sunscreen all the time and has to have it to do the things that I love to do, I had no idea that the chemicals in normal chemical-based UV blocking sunscreen really have a negative impact on the ocean and on our health as well. So when I discovered mineral sunscreen and a brand called Avasol, it was such a relief to actually know that my sunscreen could also align with my values and protect my skin and work really well, but also be kind to the oceans and to my body. And ever since then, I've been such an advocate for healthy sunscreen, which is basically mineral and non-nanoparticle sunscreen is what you want to look for. There's a lot of greenwashing in the sunscreen space. You've got to really turn those sunscreen labels around and read the ingredients.
Yeah, because they'll say zinc and they'll include zinc, but then they also still have all that other stuff in them.
Yes, and a lot of them will even say reef-friendly, but also contain a lot of chemical ingredients that are definitely not good for the ocean. So definitely want zinc or titanium non-nanoparticle as the UV blocking ingredient and the least other ingredients possible.
Because if there are nanoparticles, then they actually clog the reef too, right?
Apparently they can affect the formation of very small reproduction of plankton, corals. We don't really understand yet. And we also don't understand how nanoparticles affect our own bodies. They're absorbed directly into our bloodstream through our skin. And so there's just really not enough research yet to know whether they're harming us or not. So it seems better to avoid them.
So generally speaking, it's likely not the spray sunscreens that you would recommend. And yeah, they might make you look blue, but they keep you from sunburning. And that's really the important thing. Now, you do also feature in your book, I was thinking about these pictures, and this one's kind of bloody, right? But people get brushed up against the reef from time to time. And I've had a few nasty infections from getting brushed up against the reef when I wasn't wearing some sort of protective gear. Even a simple skin suit can help you, right? And they'll often scar pretty badly and take a long time to heal because bacteria gets inside there pretty quick. So I think, and to your point, you talk about this in your work too, that you get an infection that will just not go away. So having sunscreen and maybe a simple skin suit, if you don't want to wear sunscreen, could be helpful, right? To get into the water and enjoy it, but without like having to worry too much about a sunburn or something like this. I personally wear Lycra suit when I go snorkeling because I hate wearing sunscreen. And I might look a little silly, like a black suit head to toe, but I'm like, whatever. It looks kind of like a wetsuit and I don't really need a wetsuit, and it covers the back, so I don't have to worry about that spot in the middle of my back where I never get it quite rubbed in or whatever. then I can be out there for as long as I want to and not really worry about getting that sunburned back. Now, if you're surfing, I know it's a different world too. So
covering up is absolutely the best way to go if you can, you know, and for those spaces that you can't always have covered. Sunscreen that has less of an impact is the way to go.
In Swell, you tell the story of encountering a boar that was kept in a cage and presumably for food. Could you share that story and how it changed your outlook?
Yes. So just to give a little context, I was out on a big adventure for many months where I'd sailed to some really remote areas and had kind of the goal of trying to eat off of the out of the environments I was living in. So eating, you know, a lot of direct food directly from the sea and foraging and harvesting food on the islands where I would stop. And in general, was having my own personal revelation about our body's connection to food and how what we eat really makes how it makes us feel, and on different levels, just our physical health, but also kind of our spiritual and emotional health. And so I was out on a foraging mission that day and had just been so amazed by this newfound connection to my food and enjoying so much the practice and act of harvesting the things that I was eating. And I came upon a boar that was in a pen that was being raised presumably for food. And it was really skinny. And it seemed that maybe, I don't know what was happening, but it was clearly very, very hungry and in distress. I couldn't really do anything about it at the time. My boyfriend at the time was Polynesian, and he really discouraged me from letting him out or messing with him at all because of possibly making someone angry, whoever he belonged to. But when I looked into his eyes that day, I just felt a connection to him. I felt this asking for mercy and this concept of mercy that I had gone to Catholic school. I didn't grow up religious, but I have always been curious about religion and spirituality. And during my time at Catholic school, you spent a lot of time learning about Jesus, and remember the look in his photos and him on the cross of this, like, asking for mercy. I saw that feeling. I saw that transmitted through the eyes of the boar that day. And I decided, I kind of put it together that when I was eating meat, that it was a being that wanted to live and that I was supporting their death and by consuming meat products. And that was kind of the very beginning of my journey to trying to be vegan and plant-based diet. And from that time, several months later, I broke my neck and ended up having all this time to do some research and learn more about factory farming and about the benefits of eating more plant foods, and was able to heal really fairly quickly from a big change in diet. I cut out all dairy products and meat products and added a lot of new plant-based proteins and vitamin-rich fruits and vegetables, and had just a huge change in how my body functioned, and was just amazed by this, what seemed to be general knowledge, and the way that everyone ate actually really didn't suit my body. Once I tried a different way, I couldn't believe how good I felt and the physical changes that came to me during that new discovery, you know, in that trial time of trying out this new diet. So it became really important to me to convey those, what I'd experienced in my change of diet, to other people. And once I learned more about factory farming and how pervasive it is in almost all the meat that's available in the U.S., it became clear. And also, of course, the huge environmental impact that it has. All of those things pointed me towards shifting my diet away from meat and dairy towards more plant-based foods. So yeah, it's been a journey for sure. And there's no perfect way to do it. And it always has its difficult moments. But for me, it's had so many benefits to my health that I have no plans on turning back because of how good I feel.
Well, it's great news to see that you are doing that well, especially after breaking your neck. So many would think, oh, well, here's the side of it. You just broke your neck. So you need a lot of milk. You need a lot of protein. You need these things in order to heal. And you can't do that by being plant-based, but in actuality, you get a lot of calcium from dark leafy greens. You get a lot of proteins and all of the essential proteins for building muscle that actually come from plant-based foods as long as you're eating a balanced diet. So you might have to take more of an active perspective in your diet, but can still achieve that and come out on the other end feeling physically better because you're not eating all those processed foods. So I think that journey is very interesting. You comment in the book too about how sometimes people were getting very, very sick. And even I believe you got very, very sick eating fish that had gorged on the wrong kind of algae, which can make them essentially cytotoxic. So has that changed? Is that situation getting any better where you are in French Polynesia?
That situation has remained relatively the same as far as I know. There's definitely certain fish that you avoid and the locals even avoid. In terms of seafood in general, living where I am, it's difficult socially not to eat fish. And there are times that I make exceptions for that. But I'm always very picky about what I do consume and try to eat low on the food chain. And I think what this journey has done for me is made it so that if I do choose to eat fish in a certain moment, I really appreciate it. And I think about the life that I took. And I think that it's that consciousness in general that is really important, no matter how we're consuming meat or dairy, is to recognize where it came from and be grateful for it and understand that it was at a sacrifice of something else. So I tried really hard. It's such a personal journey and it's something that's people are very sensitive about it and can quickly feel judged about. And so I want to make it really clear that for some people, maybe that diet just doesn't work. And I feel lucky that for me, it really does because I also really love how it aligns with my personal values about wanting to have less impact on the environment and also just do less harm to other beings.
Well, I think that's the whole concept of eating for the earth. And this has been a personal struggle for me too. I've been an omnivore my whole life, right? And so for a while there, I was just very focused on, I want to make sure that the animal that I consume had a great life and maybe just a very bad last day. But then the more you learn about how our farming situations are, the very bad last day could be put on a truck to go down to a slaughtering yard in Southern California, standing for its last few days on piles of excrement. And then that last mile is a pretty horrid end. And then just feeling like, well, am I part of the problem? So initially I was following what Jonathan Safran Foer advocates for. And I know other environmentalists say things along the same lines, which is to just don't do animal products until dinner. So one meal a day as opposed to three. And then from there, sometimes people go to one meal a week or three meals a week or something like that. I first gave up dairy because I learned I was sensitive to it. I did a battery of tests because I was trying to help my son figure out what his allergies were. So I did he's three. I didn't want to poke and prod him. So poke and prod me and my husband and we'll figure out what he could have inherited, right? I gave up dairy and I stopped having acne. I was like, really? So, you know, as a 40 something year old woman, I'm just like, I still break out like at least once a month and would get painful acne sometimes, like really bad and scarring. And now I might get one or two whiteheads, like in a couple of months type thing. But that was the impact of saying goodbye to dairy. And then I gave up fish. That's a weird order to put things in. But for me, it's because I just know too much about fish. And then I interviewed Simon Setra, who's also a Patagonia author. I pulled his book out. He wrote The New Fish, which is all about the truth about farmed salmon and the consequences we can no longer ignore. I didn't realize before that, even though I know a lot about wild fishing, that we're feeding farmed fish, soy, and corn. And I'm just like, okay, wait, we're feeding these animals foods that would never exist in their diet. And so no wonder that omega-3s from salmon that's farmed are lower and omega-6s are higher. People are eating it because they think they're doing their bodies a favor and balancing out that inflammation question, and they aren't. So it's just like eating farmed beef or farmed this or farmed that. So I gave up fish, and then I was still able to maintain my omega-3 levels by supplementing. I'm in the omega-3 industry, so I use Orlo's active omegas. They're in the polar lipid form. They're highly absorbable. They don't burp back. So they're really great, right? And they're responsibly made. But I still had chicken and beef in my diet. So literally over the last month, I gave those up. And I'm in my first month as mostly plant-based. I still like, if I get a salad out and they put cheese on it, whatever, I eat it. I'm not going to be super militant on that part. But I'm mostly plant-based. I've made cookies with eggs and things that had a little bit of that, but mostly I'm on that journey and my digestion is having to change. So we talk about this as people who go plant-based, it doesn't always come without a cost because your microbiome does have to shift and you have to start building that microbiota up that can better, especially with all the beans that I'm eating, digest them. So I'm a little gassier, but I'm actually told by people who've gone this path that 5 weeks later, a lot of that will have subsided. So it's kind of like this, I still feel great. My energy's high. I've continued to drop some weight and I've been able to retain muscle mass. So I know that that's the protein lie is alive and well too, right? Like I'm getting enough protein and I'm maintaining my muscle mass. I lift heavy weights. So it's good to see that continue. But this is part of my personal journey. And I'm fully in your court of like, there's no reason to be judgmental. I think we're all on this journey together. We can start to look at meat as more of a condiment and make shifts that feel right for us when they feel right for us. But, you know, I'm probably still going to host barbecues and my husband's going to make all the meat in the world because he's not coming on this journey with me. And they might eat more plant-based foods because that's what I'm cooking, but he still wants to have a burger. And that's okay too.
Totally fine. Yeah. All you can do is be the example and take your own journey. And maybe you will undoubtedly inspire more people around you than you realize to just maybe try something new. And that's kind of how it can all start for people. You know, I think it's really just important that we're supportive of each other wherever we are on the journey.
And I just am not going to be one of those holier than thou. There's this joke about how do you know a vegan CrossFitter? Don't worry, they'll tell you.
Sure, I know.
It's funny. It's like, because it's a little bit true, right?
And I think when you first discover all those benefits, like you're genuinely just like excited about telling people. But I learned very quickly in that being too vocal and being too forceful about sharing that stuff, I think you end up losing the audience altogether. So more good is done by being and leading the example quietly in your own life and hoping others take notice.
Yeah. Well, I got to say, you know, I'm connected to a couple of not-for-profits that are basically sanctuary for would-be farm animals and giving them the best possible lives that they can. That's really hard work. And I've witnessed it firsthand. I also know what it takes to run a farm because I've ridden horses my whole life and I grew up on a working farm. So it's like, it's a lot of work to keep all the animals happy and fed and healthy and the vet checks and everything else that goes along the way. So if you are curious about that style thing, you can make tours of local farms that are trying to do things differently. There's ways that you can get involved in your local environments, just to educate yourself and become more informed. And then there's not-for-profits out there like Mercy for Animals that are just trying to advocate for some basic rights on behalf of farm animals so that pigs that are grown for food have better living conditions while they're alive. And the same thing with cows, and the same thing with goats or other animals, just that we are being more merciful, to your earlier point. So I think advocating for those things, even as you continue to consume meat or animal products, is really paramount to success across the board. Now, I know that, of course, you're an ocean advocate and you bring awareness to problems like overfishing and wearing the right sunscreen and having mercy for these animals too. What more can we do, in your opinion, to support ocean ecosystem recovery? Because, hey, if we don't have a thriving ocean, things get really bad.
Yeah, absolutely. I think in general, all the things that we do for the environment are connected to the ocean. So general things like refusing and reducing our consumption, refusing single-use plastic, making really conscious choices about who we buy from and who we support. Those are all really great things. And trying to reuse things that we have and upcycle and generally just make things last as long as possible, so we don't have to buy more all the time. Directly related to the oceans, I think it's really awesome to try to get in touch with your local organizations in your area and either support them financially if you can, or lend a hand and pitch in to different events that they host, or learn how to become an advocate for the projects that are in your area or working on near you. I have been immersed in nonprofit work now since kind of I finished writing Swell, and I realize how critical that support is now to the people who are, you know, have dedicated their lives to these issues. So it sometimes doesn't feel as meaningful as you'd like it to give $25 a month or that type of thing, but it really truly does have such a huge impact for the grassroots organizations that are really on the front lines doing this work and figuring out solutions on the ground. So,
yeah. And often so many of the people that are working with them are donating their time if they don't have the financial resources. So you could be great at running data analysis and putting content into spreadsheets and making it digestible. You can donate your time to do something like that, or you might be able to create an app for a company. There's so many ways that you can contribute that don't have to end up being financial and that can have just as much of an impact, if not even a greater one, if those resources lack. So I advocate for that as well. Volunteering can be really important to help you feel like you're putting more good into the world too. Now, you have a not-for-profit in Tahiti. Do you want to talk about that for a moment?
Sure. So after writing Swell, I was kind of ready to grow some roots, and I met my now husband, and basically both of us really wanted to give back to the community where he's from. And I had been kind of doing this advocacy work through social media and kind of on a level of more like awareness for many, many years. And I was ready to kind of get my hands dirty and try to really live out the Act Local slogan and see what that was like. And so kind of a group of surfers at the beginning that were sick of complaining to each other about some of the local issues in the community kind of got together and decided to create this nonprofit called Atia Materia Island Protectors.
See, I needed you to say it because I'm like, I'm not going to pronounce this correctly again. Atia
Materia basically means Tahitian, stand up for your island.
Okay, I love it.
Yeah, so we had kind of like diverse issues that we wanted to affront at first. One being there's a overpopulation of dogs and cats in this community, and both for the environment and for the people and for the animals, it was an issue that we thought was really important to address. And so we've been working on that since our inception in 2019 and have made a lot of great progress. We've received last year the first ever grant in French Polynesia for spay and neuter. Now this year that we have a second grant, and the grant has been extended to lots of other animal welfare organizations in the country. So very exciting to see that moving in a positive direction. We also have several projects for the environment going on. We are working on several different marine protected areas with the fishermen. We've been working with the fishermen since 2021 to come up with solutions for overfishing within the lagoons. So this is like very near shore fishing that's affecting.
So it's often where the young fish are, the estuaries, right?
Young fish. And basically why I was mentioning that is more to say that these are subsistence fishermen who are either living directly off the fish to feed their families or living off the fish to sell and feed their families. So we worked off of a model that Dr. Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson, I'm sure you're familiar with her work. She kind of had the model of talking and involving the fishermen in the process of creating these new fishing regulations or these no fishing zones. And so, yeah, we did 100 different interviews with fishermen around our island. And since then have watched the different projects for new fishing regulations and marine protected areas in these 8 different districts that we worked in kind of like arise naturally through new leaders that saw that other people had a desire to do this. And then with our support, because we can do the grant writing and the things that are complicated for a lot of these fishermen, we're able to support them. And so those projects have been really satisfying and felt really like direct hands-on ocean protection to see those new, they're called Rahui, traditional Tahitian.
So needed. I'm just like, I want to applaud you right now because that is like, it's really hard work. I mean, you talk about 100 interviews. That takes a lot of time and effort and even just outreach to get them to agree to those interviews. That's a ton of work.
Yeah. We have a meeting this afternoon for one of the last ones that we're trying to get put in place. It's like the biggest area of lagoon. And it's really, really important because a lot of the fishermen in this area live directly off fishing. And so we're basically trying to preserve their way of life because as it's going right now, you know, fishing might not be a possible career anymore if we overfish these lagoons. So it's very exciting, but very complex, as you said, and takes a lot of patience. And yeah, so lots of really neat stuff going on. And I'm lucky to have a super awesome team that works really well together. And we're all volunteer at this point. We have received several grants for the specific projects, but we are all just dating our time at this point. And for me, that's thanks to Patagonia still supporting me as a surf ambassador and believing in what I'm doing here in French Polynesia. So I'm super lucky.
Well, I believe in what you're doing. And I also believe in Patagonia for the level of support they're putting into the world of not only not-for-profits, but trying to feature things like regenerative organic and talk to people about the problems of the way that we've been farming. I mean, these are really important conversations that we need to have on a global scale. And then to your point, in local communities too. I recently learned that there's more pressure on the Peruvian government to basically say, okay, I know our catch size, we had this for the size of the nets, but now we want to go lower. And like every time they reduce net size, it increases the catch of smaller, the more juvenile fish. So you're basically just saying, okay, so the industry is pressuring the government and they're going to be squeezed. And this is basically moving into this conversation now where you're like, okay, so we're just flat out going to overfish now, right? Like we're going to all agree that that's what we're doing. Is that what's happening? So these things are scary. Having the pressures of the economic system on that, these subsistence farmers or subsistence fishermen, it's kind of the same story. They're just doing their best to get by. So it's one part education resource, like, hey, we need to have a healthy, thriving ecosystem. So these are the things we need to do. It's one part also enforcement. And then you have to have a system to enforce because you could have this fear that, okay, well, somebody else is going to go out. They're not going to respect this rule. And they're just going to take all the fish home and then I'm going to starve and that guy's going to get rich type thing. So it's complex.
Yeah, absolutely. Traditionally, you know, Tahitians had a system of resource management that kind of broke down through the years of colonization. And so right now we're really trying to kind of look back at those ways of doing things from before and pull what we can forward and give people here a sense of pride in that history. And here, you know, that's a key factor in making it work, because it has to be something that people can be proud of and people see a connection to. If it's laws that are being imposed from up down, you see less success in these kinds of things. And when you have those economic pressures of big industry coming in and pushing people around, it's so hard. Luckily here in the projects that we're working on, the fishermen themselves have a lot of power over what happens in their lagoons. And so, yeah, giving them their voice to make it their project and make it come from their ideas. And they're the ones out there seeing what's really happening every day. And so in general, it makes me wish that science and the communication between scientists and the people who are out there in the field for whatever profession or whatever economic resource, you wish that there was more communication, because there's so much knowledge on either side that they both need and to do better. And when you see it happen that way, there's just a lot more success.
So I think it's this whole concept that Paul Hawken also advocates for, and something I spoke with him earlier about on this podcast, which was to make Earth a stakeholder at the table. And to do that, you need to capture this local wisdom of the environment as well. And it sounds like that's exactly what you're working to do. So thank you so much for that. This has been, I think, a really great interview. I encourage my audience to pick up your book, Swell, A Sailing Surfer's Voyage of Awakening. I listened to the audiobook as well, but the physical book is beautiful. And this is going to be out May 14th, 2024, I believe, and paperback as well. So it's a great journey. And thank you for continuing that amazing work in Tahiti and for being an ocean advocate. Also wanted to just point people to another project you're involved in. And I know we're over time here. So that is this not-for-profit that actually connects women that is called Changing Tides Foundation, a nonprofit that's focused on supporting women who are striving to make a difference in the world. As a woman who's striving to make a difference in the world, I didn't know about that not-for-profit. So now I'm going to look into it if you want to make a recommendation there for someone I should interview.
Oh, yes, please. I can definitely connect you with all of my sea sisters there. It was founded by some of my best friends and surfers, other ocean-loving women, really wanted to create a space to empower other women to protect the planet and find their voice and their way to do that. And also to make the ocean and surfing a more inclusive and beautiful space for women. And so, yeah, Changing Tides is, I'm so lucky to have been involved and watch it grow. And I'm just an honorary board member at this point, but so proud of what they've done. And a lot of the focus now is getting women out in the ocean. And we have several different projects, like this month is Plant-Based March. So encouraging people to learn more about plant-based eating. And then we do a plastic swear jar during Earth Month, where people count their single-use plastic, kind of like a swear jar concept. Lots of cool programs to help you raise your awareness in your own life and also get involved with the different programs that we have. So yeah, definitely encourage you to check out Changing Tides.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. I hope that one day we get to connect in person, perhaps in Tahiti on a sailboat like Swell.
Come on down.
I mean, I love sailing. I will spend more time on the ocean anytime. And I'm one of those people who has only been seasick under really rough seas. So
it's like good crew.
Yeah, good crew member, and I've done plenty of live aboard boat diving. So I've been on some larger vessels and some smaller ones to explore our underwater world. I need to do more of that. I've never been to Tahiti, so perhaps one day I'll just come right your way.
Let me know.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. Thanks for what you're doing here to spread all this goodness. I appreciate you.
Oh, I appreciate you. To find out more about Captain Liz Clark and her book, Swell, A Sailing Surfer's Voyage of Awakening, which is available wherever books are sold, the paperback copy is coming out May 14th. It's also on Audible, and she reads it herself. It's an incredible story. I encourage you to check it out. You can visit links in my show notes for direct links to everywhere to find the book. And at the tail end of the blog, you will find additional resources and past episodes on similar topics of interest, including my interview with Dr. Wallace J. Nichols, which I mentioned at the beginning of today's episode. He's a renowned marine biologist who authored Blue Mind, an interview with Jean-Michel Cousteau and his work with regard to the Ocean Futures Society, and even my interviews with other Patagonia Press authors, including Simon Setra, who wrote The New Fish, and also Stephen Hawley, who wrote a book called Cracked, The Future of Dams in a Hot, Chaotic World. If you enjoyed today's episode, please rate, review, and subscribe wherever you're picking up this podcast. Give us a thumbs up, shoot us a comment or a direct message, and subscribe to the newsletter on caremorebebetter.com. We send out one email a week, not more, and subscribers receive a free 5-step guide to help unleash your inner activist so you can champion something in your local neck of the woods too. Thank you, listeners and watchers, now and always, for being a part of this pod and this community, because together we really can do so much more. We can care more, we can be better, we can even step into our truths, learn to listen to our intuition, and create that better blue world together. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Care More, Be Better, a podcast for social good. To make sure you never miss an episode, subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen to podcasts. And share with your friends to help us reach more people and spread more social good.